Okay. Well, thanks for inviting me to the conference and giving me the opportunity to speak. So what I've been working on for the past couple of years is classifying supersymmetric solutions, a topic that Tuan just mentioned at the end of his talk. And what I mean by classification is a precise characterization of the necessary and sufficient conditions for a solution to the equations of motion to preserve supersymmetry, in other words, to make Killing spinners. That's what I mean by a classification. And once you have that, the nice thing is that in many situations, it gives a new vehicle for finding exact explicit solutions, which have a number of applications. And I'm not going to tell you much about what has been the key tool, but in these three papers, basically we started off this program, and there's basically something called a G structure, which is a generalization of special holonomy, which is kind of a key organizational principle for doing a lot of the calculations. And we've applied the idea in sort of three broad ways. The first way is the obvious thing, is you just try and get the most general supergravity solution of 10 or 11 dimensional supergravity. And it's rather surprising that you can do that in great detail. But the actual result you get is a little bit too general to be so useful. So in the basic situation, you get the most general solution preserving 132 supersymmetry, and it's a little too general to be too useful. But people are generalizing this or refining this classification and getting the conditions for 2, 3, 4, and so on in supersymmetries. So I expect actually more progress to happen in this area. What's been much more fertile in the shorter term is applying the same principle to supergravities in lower dimensions. And the structure of these supergravities is just much simpler, so we can be much more explicit. And at 4, 5, 6, and 7 dimensions, you can carry out the program, and you start to find exact explicit solutions. Well, we will hear a lot about black rings tomorrow, Gödel spacetimes, and Riehl and Gutowski have made some progress using the general results, not just the explicit solutions, to try and make progress towards finding black hole uniqueness theorems. They're not yet there yet, but there's hope that that could be pushed further. And the third option is sort of something that people have been doing on and off for many years in the supergravity world, is just to look at the special class of solutions, and the obvious one is, say, compactifications in Minkowski force spaces, flux, or compactifications to ADS spaces. And what I wanted to do today, I was asked to review a little bit of the progress in this area, and rather than actually go through and discuss all of these things, particularly because we'll hear about a lot about this tomorrow, I just want to actually review this little corner down here. And if people are interested, they can ask me about these other developments privately. So the plan is to give you a flavor of how far one can push things in looking for ADS5 solutions of 11 dimensions. So we've got a complete classification of these kinds of geometry, and also a raft of new solutions. And the bonus of these investigations is that it led to the construction of use of cyclic Einstein metrics in 5 and 7 dimensions, which I'll review. So this is work that I did with Dario Mattelli, a postdoc at CERN, James Sparks, a postdoc at Harvard, and Dan Waldron, my colleague at Imperial. So this is basically reviewing this work, and then the second half of the talk, or the last third, will be describing some new work that I've been doing with postdocs at Imperial, Sengmin Lee, Tony Mateo, and Dan Waldron again, about deforming some ADS4 solutions in 11 dimensions. So the three topics will be somewhat self-contained. So if you lose the track at some point, then you can just come in later. So let me say something about the classification of ADS5 solutions in 11 dimensions. And until recently, it was very surprising that there was actually very few explicit examples. I mean, given the enormous amount of work that was done in this area, people hadn't really actually tried to construct ADS5 solutions with much effort or in any systematic way. So the solutions that were known, the basic solutions, were ADS5 cross Y5, where only the 5 form is switched on, and Y5 is a Sasaki-Einstein manifold. Sasaki-Einstein is simply the statement that this metric, this cone metric, so here we have a radial direction, R squared times this, so this is the base of this cone, and if that metric is Calabi-Yau, then it's equivalent to the statement that Y5 is Sasaki-Einstein. So that metric there is the near horizon limit of D3 brains sitting at the apex of this cone. chalk. So that's the basic setup. And in terms of explicit examples, obviously if we put S5 here, this is just R6, so that's obviously Clabial. If we put T11 there, then this is what's known as the conifold, and that's Clabial. Both these spaces are homogeneous, and both of the dual field theories are known. But that's basically that was the full list when if you asked for explicit metrics. So there's a lot more progress done on this without actually having explicit metrics. But in terms of explicit metrics, those are just two examples. And in 11 dimensions, I'm not going to mention this too much, but there were two examples, one with n equals 1 and one with n equals 2 supersymmetry that Meldacena and Nunes discovered, which were M5 rings wrapped around holomorphic curves in Clabial twofolds or threefolds. But because they're M5 rings, the field theories remain a bit obscure. Okay, so what we did was just apply the G-structured machine to this situation. And we just said, what is the most general supersymmetric configuration of this form? So it's, here we have ADS5, direct product with a six-dimensional manifold, and I put this warp factor in here. So this is the most general metric that preserves SO42 symmetry. So the most general way you can get a four-dimensional conformal field theory, preserving supersymmetry, will have a metric like that in 11 dimensions. And the four form must be just a four form on the six-dimensional manifold. So then the question is, what is the most general six-manifold, four-form, and scalar field such that it's supersymmetric? And you just apply this tool, and you just push ahead. And I'm not going to tell you what the answer is exactly. It's there's an SU2 structure on this manifold, and part of the data is a one-parameter family of Kähler metrics, four-dimensional Kähler metrics. That's part of the data that goes into it. But if you want to get the actual equations that you need to solve to actually find explicit solutions to PDEs. So that's as far as you can take the general story. But what was surprising and nice is that we made one additional assumption that the six-dimensional manifold is a complex manifold. So in general, it's not a complex manifold. It has an almost complex structure, but it's not integrable in general. We just assumed that it's integrable, and then it turns out that these PDEs miraculously turn into ODEs, and then you can solve them explicitly. So you get all these explicit solutions. So I just wanted to summarize a little bit what these explicit solutions are. So firstly, I'm not going to write down any metrics, but let me describe that the topology is S2 bundles over a four-dimensional base. So metrically, it's not a round two-sphere, but topologically, it is a two-sphere that's fibered over a four-dimensional base. And the metrics for the full solution is completely specified if you know what the metric is on the four-dimensional base. And the metric on the four-dimensional base could be in one of two classes. Actually, I don't think I mentioned, but if you assume M6 is complex and the manifold is compact, then this is the full set of regular solutions. Modulo one technical point, which you can ask me about if you're interested. In any case, if the metric on the four-dimensional base is completely specified, then the six-dimensional metric is completely specified. And it's either a Kähler-Einstein base with positive scalar curvature, or it's a product space. So let me remind you, well, we had the definition of Kähler in the last lecture by Chuan. It's just the covariantly constant J, and Einstein means that the Ricci tensor is just proportional to the metric, and I said it has positive curvature, so this constant is positive. And the nice thing is that that class of manifolds are being classified by Tian and Yao, and they're either S2 cross S2 or CP2, of course, those metrics are explicit. Or it's a Delpezzo manifold. And Delpezzo is a CP2, and then you blow up a number of points with two spheres. And you can either have K is 3 to 8. 1 and 2 are not Kähler-Einstein, Delpezzo 1 and 2. So if you take these two, the bases in these two spaces, you get an explicit six-dimensional manifold, which goes into an ADS5 plus M6 solution. If you choose these ones, well, everything's explicit up to the metric on these spaces, which is not known. Alternatively, B4 is a product, and it can either be S2 cross S2, S2 cross H2, or S2 cross T2. And you'll notice that there's a repetition here, but I put this in here because you can have the radii of the two two-spheres being different, and then it's not Einstein. Also, I said compact, and you say, well, that's not compact. Well, it turns out for some class of solutions, you can take a quotient of this H2 and get a compact Riemann surface. Okay, so that's nice. And I might just point out that in this class here, there's a special class. I said it's an S2 bundle over S2 cross H2. Well, a degenerate, when you take a limit of those classes of solutions, the S2 and the S2 piece together to form a four-sphere. So it's actually a four-sphere bundle over H2, and that's exactly one of these Meldacena-Nunez solutions with N equals 1 supersymmetry. So it's nice we've got this explicit class of solutions. It would be nice if we could say something about the field theory, but again, it's like the Meldacena-Nunez solutions. It's something to do with fibrains. It's something to do with intersecting fibrains going to the near horizon limit, and that's just unfortunately remains obscure at the moment. The other thing you might ask, because I said this is the N equals 1 Meldacena-Nunez solution, sits inside of this class, but where's the Meldacena-N equals 2 solution? Well, the strange thing is that it's not in the class where M6 is complex. So there's, in this case, supersymmetry and complexity of the manifold are completely orthogonal ideas. So this solution has more supersymmetry than this one, yet this is not a complex manifold, and this is a complex manifold. It's a unique situation in supersymmetry, as far as I know. Okay, so actually that's all I wanted to say about the classification of these 11-dimensional ADS5 solutions. So this would be a good point to see if there's any questions just on this part of the talk. Okay, so let's take one class of solutions. So we'll just take this one, in fact. So out of all these class solutions, we'll just consider this one with the S2 cross T2. So it's an S2 bundle over S2 cross T2. And we'll do the obvious thing, that we'll dimensionally reduce on one of the S1s of this 2 torus, and then T-dualize on the other S1. And if you do that, then you find that all the fluxes somewhat miraculously piece together to just give you a 5-form flux. So 5-form flux and nothing else. And given that, and this preserves supersymmetry, well, you need to check it preserves supersymmetry. You need to check that the T-duality and the dimensional reduction commuted with supersymmetry, that it does. So given that, then if this is supersymmetric, then an X5 must be a Sasaki-Einstein manifold. So this gives us a way of constructing explicitly such Sasaki-Einstein manifolds. However, the other thing you need to check is actually that this is really regular. And if you go through this procedure, the condition for regularity of this is really that the fluxes, you have to start off with a regular manifold, but you also have to make sure the fluxes are properly quantized in the 11-dimensional solution. So that would be one way to check that these actually are regular manifolds. But what we actually did was the reverse. We just took these manifolds obtained this way and just directly checked that they are complete metrics. And what you find is it gives an infinite number of new metrics, and they all have the topology S2 cross S3. So the S2 bundle over S2 cross T2, when you reduce on a circle, you sort of have S2 cross S2 cross F1, and then you T-dualize, but that S1 then gets fibered over the other S2s in such a way to produce this topology. And topologically they're S2 cross S3, but they're also, you can view them as they're all S1 bundles over S2 cross T2, and this is exactly like T11, the base of the conifold. So T11 has a unit winding number over each of the two spheres, but these YPQ spaces, as we'll call them, have winding P over one 2-sphere and Q over another 2-sphere. And just in case you're thinking this must all sound very much like TPQ, I'm only talking about the topology here. The metric is not a direct product metric. So metrically, it's not a direct product, but topologically it is. Okay, so let me explain a little bit more about these metrics. So I'll introduce just a little bit more terminology. So as I said, Sasaki-Einstein is directly equivalent to this cone metric being Calabi-Yau threefold. Well, if this is the Calabi-Yau threefold, there's a canonical vector, d by dr, just scaling up along the cone direction, and we can contract that in with a complex structure, and that will give us another vector. And the condition that this is Calabi-Yau turns out to mean that this vector is both killing and has constant norm. Okay? And that killing vector, so this is going into an ADS5 cross X5 solution, that killing vector exactly corresponds to the U1R symmetry of the four-dimensional conformal field theory, and U1 inverted commas, and I'll explain that in a moment. So this had to happen just because of ADS-CFT.
Gerald,
No, the next transparency. That's a very good question. So locally the metric can be written from what I've said in this form. So I said it's a killing vector, so both sigma, this one form, and this four-dimensional base here don't depend on psi. That's just saying it's killing. And I said that the killing vector had constant norm, which I scaled to 1 in this here. And if you piece it together, d sigma turns out to be related to j of b4, and b4 has to be locally Kähler-Einstein. So you might ask, well, that's fine locally, what about globally? Well, it turns out that there are 3 possibilities. So the Sasaki-Einstein is either regular Sasaki-Einstein, quasi-regular Sasaki-Einstein, or irregular Sasaki-Einstein. And it's all to do with precisely what Devin said. It's whether or not it's exactly how this killing vector, the orbit of this killing vector, specifies the 3 different cases. So the simplest case is that when that local picture I just mentioned is true globally. So in that case, we really do indeed have a UNR symmetry, and it's free. Completely free. All the isotropy groups of each point are the same. Although all the isotropy groups are trivial, I should say. In other words, that means that vibration is globally defined, so the Kähler-Einstein base is globally defined. So then you're just looking for Kähler-Einstein bases with positive scalar curvature. But I already told you in a different context what that list is. So Tian and Yao said it's either CP2, it's S2 cross S2, or it's the Dolpetzos. So that same classification ends up in this slightly different Sasaki-Einstein context. And we have S5, T11, and a bunch of Dolpetzo, a Sasaki-Einstein manifold constructed with the Dolpetzo. The next possibility is that the orbits of the killing vector close, but they have different isotropy groups. So if the norm of the killing vector is constant, all that can happen is the size of the orbits can be different sizes. So instead of going around 2 pi, there could be another point where the orbit just goes around pi. So the different choices are going to be finite subgroups of U1, which is just Zn. So in this case, that local picture is almost well-defined. It's well-defined except that the base now turns out to be an orbifold, and it's precisely an orbifold at the points where the orbits have reduced sizes. So there were some examples, implicit examples in this category, basically exploiting this fact that these are orbifolds. And finally, the third possibility is that, in fact, the R symmetry is non-compact, so the orbits of this killing vector just never close. And for that to happen, you need another killing vector, and the obvious picture is, for example, if you have a 2 torus, and here's obviously orbits of killing vectors are closed, that if we just take the pitch of the killing vector to be irrationally related, it will just wind around the torus and never close. So in the case when you have 2 killing symmetries and one of them just is sort of irrationally pitched around this torus, then you're getting, that's a good model for what an irregular Sasaki-Einstein manifold is doing. And in that case, that local vibration is still well-defined locally, but it's not true globally, and in particular, there's no way in which to make any sense of B4 as a manifold. So these irregular Sasaki-Einstein, that vibration picture is completely hopeless in terms of constructing solutions, and that's maybe why it was seemed to be difficult to construct those metrics. So that's basically the different kinds of Sasaki-Einstein. What about the ones we found? Well, the YPQ metrics, coming from 11 dimensions by that T-duality and dimension reduction and T-duality, are the first explicit examples in this quasi-regular class and the first examples in the irregular class. And in fact, there was actually conjectures, in the math literature saying that they couldn't exist. But in fact, they do, and they're in fact quite very simple to write down, and everything's explicit. Okay, so let me say a little bit more about them. The isometry group of the whole class of metrics is SU2 cross U1 cross U1. And for the people who are familiar with T11, T11 has SU2 cross SU2 cross U1 isometry. The topology is S2 cross S3, just like T11. So in some sense, you can think of them as a one-parameter family of deformations, or two-parameter family deformations of T11. The construction of once you have the actual metrics, the way you actually construct them is take a two-sphere, take another two-sphere, fiber that over the two-sphere, and then take a U1 fibration over that. And you can generalize that construction to any odd dimension, actually. So you take a Kähler-Einstein base, take a two-sphere, fiber that over the Kähler-Einstein base, and then take another U1 and fiber it over that. And that construction works in all dimensions. So in terms of physics, the only application that I know of is in seven dimensions, and I'll return to that a little bit later. Okay, what about the dual conformal field theory? Well, here we're doing just these three brains sitting at the apex of these cones, so we have a much better control over the field theories. So from the geometry, one can make a number of predictions. The first is that the symmetries of the field theory should be SU2 cross U1 cross U1, the isometries of the manifold, and there's another baryonic U1 because we have a three-sphere in the geometry. So you take the four-form potential coming from the five-form field strength, and that will give you another U1, which gives you a baryonic U1. The central charges will last simple to calculate. Once you have an explicit metric, all you need to do is calculate the volume of the manifold, and then the ratio of the central charge of these YPQ conformal field theories to S5 is just given by this ratio, and that is given by that explicit formula there. And in fact, when this is rational, so you can now see explicitly that this is irrational in general. So this is irrational, and when it's irrational, it's precisely the irregular Sasaki-Einstein case. So when the orbits of the U1 don't close, the central charges are irrational, exactly as you'd expect. And when this 4p squared minus 3q squared is an integer squared, this is rational, and you're in the quasi-regular case. And actually, you can solve that equation, 4p squared minus 3q squared is n squared, explicitly. You can actually solve that problem in closed form. Okay, for pushing ahead, the baryons will arise from D3 brains wrapping supersymmetric 3 cycles. And remember that a supersymmetric 3 cycle in this context corresponds to a 4 cycle, a divisor. I don't know how to draw it. A 4 cycle on the cone. So if you have a 4 cycle on the cone, that's a divisor, then on the base, on Y5, that will give rise to a 3-dimensional supersymmetric cycle, which you can wrap D3 brains along, and they correspond to baryons in the dual field theory. And you can work out the R charges of these baryons with some general formula. I've forgotten exactly who derived this formula. I think it may be in Herzog and Klebanov. Need to work out the area of your cycle divided by the total volume of the space, and you'll get some formula like this. There's no point in writing it down, but it's just related to P and Q, and it's in general got some these 4p squared minus 3q squared terms appear. Well, relatively last few, several months, people have now established what the dual field theory is. And it's the Quiver gauge theory, the difficulty was actually working out the superpotential. But the way in which these people basically got a hold of this was that, first of all, the Calabi-Yau manifold is toric. So being toric is very helpful. Well, Hanani and company have got a procedure that if you have a toric manifold, of how to actually build the dual Quiver field theory. The other point that's of interest is that the limit when you take P to Q, so YPP is like some orbital fold. There might be another Z2 of S5. So basically, the procedure for getting these Quiver gauge theories is take the Quiver gauge theory of S5 mod ZP, and then there's a procedure to change some of the links in a precise way. And there's a procedure to get the superpotential for each of the different cases. In any case, that's these guys' work, which was extremely nice. And what's very nice is that you can use this procedure of A maximization to determine the central charges. So remember, the A maximization says that the R symmetry of the conformal fixed point is given by a linear combination of the U1s that maximizes the contribution to the Tuft anomaly. And you can work that out given their data, and it exactly reproduces those formulas with all those factors. that exactly reproduces that formula and the similar formula for the volume of the baryons, the arc charges of the baryons. So that's a very nice story. So now the situation has changed. We now have an infinite number of ADS-CFG examples in five dimensions, where both the geometry and the field theory are explicitly known. And there's some obvious generalizations that people are trying to do, like, for example, Klebanov-Strassler. So the Klebanov-Stateland type solution has been constructed, and people are thinking about Klebanov-Strassler solution. Yeah. That may involve, that may be much more complicated than Klebanov-Strassler. And naively, it's going to be, Klebanov-Strassler solution is cohomogeneity 1, which means you're solving ODEs. But naively, these solutions are going to be cohomogeneity 2, and you'll need to solve PDEs. So this could be very difficult, but maybe it's not. Maybe it's not difficult.
Do the boundary field theories have a weak coupling limit? Can you go to weak coupling in these field theories?
Yeah. Oh, well, they're just in the quiver field theory, quiver gauge theories with a superpotential. I mean, it's just like the conifold. They have quartic terms, cubic and quartic terms. No, that's right. The anomalous dimensions are large. Yeah, that's right.
I guess there's no general math results about resolving that singularity. How would it resolve it?
Yeah, so Klebanov-Strassler was taking the conifold and then deforming it, and then there was a procedure that people had to just build the solution around that. So it's not clear that you can even deform these YPQ singularities in the same way. So the toric description says that there's some ways of resolving this, a bit like resolving the conifold rather than deforming the conifold. So you can do that, but it's not clear yet if you can deform it. There's the analog of the deformation. So it may be that the analog of Klebanov-Strassler is not just finding a smooth Klebiow and then switching on fluxes, it's switching on all sorts of new fluxes, and you can only resolve it really in 2B string theory with a much more complicated solution. That's just a bit unclear at the moment, but it's a very interesting question. So one other thing about this field theory, which doesn't seem to be particularly useful, but just to amplify, is just to remind you where I got the solutions from. They were from 11 dimensions. I did reduction and t-duality. So these field theories have both a 2B description and an M-theory description. Of course, the M-theory description is probably not particularly useful for anything at the moment, but it's rather unusual that you can have field theories with, well, this whole family of field theories has different descriptions, either in M-theory or 2B. Okay, is there any more questions on that? Because I wanted to switch gear to the third topic. Okay. So when you have a supersymmetric conformal field theory, they can often have exactly marginal deformations, preserving the superconformal symmetry. And the basic example is if you say in four dimensions with four supercharges, then you're going to have beta functions, a beta function for each of your different coupling constants, and when you set them to equal to zero to get the fixed point, you roughly have as many equations to solve as you have couplings. And you won't get, you'll typically just get isolated solutions to those equations. But if your beta functions are related to anomalous dimensions as they are in these supersymmetric theories, then if you have a theory that has less anomalous dimensions than you have couplings, then typically you're getting less equations than, you have less coupling. When you solve those equations, you typically find families of solutions rather than isolated solutions. So these exactly marginal deformations of CFTs are rather common. So for example, in four dimensions, n equals four supersymmetric young mills, it's known to have a three complex family of such deformations. And one of them, which is called the beta deformation, I don't know exactly why it's called the beta deformation, but it is called the beta deformation, it preserves a U1 cross U1 symmetry. And it turns out that it also exists in other four-dimensional conformal field theories that have a U1 cross U1 symmetry. and ADS5 cross T11 is one, and ADS5 cross YTQ is another one. So all these have this particular beta deformation, but it's, I just point out that it's just one deformation of a rich family of deformations. So if we know the ADS dual solution, can we find the corresponding deformed solution? In fact, this question was first asked by Aharoni, Cole, and Yankee Elevitz a number of years ago, and they worked tremendously hard trying to construct these solutions in perturbation theory. People have looked at that paper. It's very impressive. However, Luna and Meldacena cut the Gordian knot quite dramatically and showed that these particular deformations can be constructed in an incredibly simple fashion. And I think you need to look at that paper to appreciate how beautiful this idea is. In any case, this is the idea, very simple. So you take ADS5 cross X5, and X5 has a U1, and you assume that X5 has a U1 cross U1 isometry. Well, if it has a U1 cross U1 isometry, this 10-dimensional solution is actually a solution of 8-dimensional supergravity. An 8-dimensional supergravity has, as a supergravity, a duality group which is SL2R cross SL3R. And there's an SL2R, actually this is not right, there's an SL2R and this SL3R, this SL2 sitting in here, which acts on this particular combination. So B12 is the two components in these two U1 directions, and here is the metric on the two torus. And the observation of Luna and Meldacena is simply the following, that this particular element of SL2R, where you take tau to tau and 1 plus gamma tau, it will generate a new regular solution, which will uplift to a new ADS5 solution, and typically will have additional fluxes. So the key point here is simply, there's this two torus with a tau parameter, with this tau parameter, by assumption, it's a regular solution. So we have a two torus, but it's not a global fibration. That two torus can shrink down at various points. But the way it shrinks down is precisely the way in which to maintain regularity. So I can't draw a good picture, but if we just think of a two sphere has this U1 fibration, which is obviously breaking down at the poles, but the way it breaks down at the poles is precisely the way in which that metric remains regular. Similarly, in this context, the way tau, or the torus, goes to zero size, it does it in such a way by assumption that the metric is regular. And then you just simply notice with this element of SL2 that when tau goes to zero, tau is just going to tau. So the behavior as tau goes to zero is exactly unchanged in the solution you started with and the transform solution. That was their key observation of Luna and Meldacena. Incredibly simple, but very powerful. So that's where you get the new solution. And if the U1 cross U1 isometry commutes with supersymmetry, so it means that it commutes with the R symmetry. So the simplest way to do that is if you have X5 that has U1 cross U1 cross U1R isometry, then you just pick the other U1 cross U1 to do this procedure, and the final solution will preserve supersymmetry. So the examples that you can apply this to are ADS5 cross S5, T1, ADS5 cross T1, 1, and ADS5 cross YPQ. But the idea is much more general, and you can break supersymmetry if you like, but then you'll have the usual problems about whether the final solution is stable, perturbatively or non-perturbatively. But you can also do these deformations for non-conformal field theory, like Levinov-Strasbourg. But they kept going, and they said, well, you can also do this to 11-dimensional solutions. If you have an ADS solution in 11 dimensions that has a U1 cubed action, then once again, you can reduce this 11-dimensional solution to 8 dimensions. And now the point is that there's the explicit SL2R in the SL2R cross SL3R duality group is now acting on this tau parameter. So this is the tau parameter of this 3 torus. So C1, 2, 3 are the three components in the U1 cube directions, and this is the metric on that 3 torus. And what they did is applied this to ADS4 cross S7. So what we simply did is just ask the question, can we generalize this further to a richer class of solutions with ADS4 factors in 11 dimensions. So what I'd like to do is just tell you about the metrics we considered and a few of the results. So the class of metrics we're interested in, this is not the most general class of ADS4 metrics, but it's a simple class, is ADS4 cross H7 And the four-form flux is just a proportion of the volume form on this ADS-4 factor. So this is just the basic Freund-Rubin compactification of 11-dimensional supergravity. And these arise in exactly the same way as these D3 brains in five-dimensional Sasaki Einstein. If I just simply just change this to 7, and this to M2, so this is now, this eight-dimensional space has to have special holonomy. And if it has special holonomy, then the this solution preserves supersymmetry. So in the most generic case, the cone metric built out of it with H7 has spin 7 holonomy, and just by definition, it's just a phrase, H7 then is said to be weak G2, and the conformal field theory has N equals 1 supersymmetry now in 3 dimensions. If the cone has 2 killing spinners, so it's a Calabi-Yau 4-fold, not 8-fold, H7 is Sasaki-Einstein now in 7 dimensions, and the field theory has N equals 2 supersymmetry. And finally, it can be hyperkähler, the 8-dimensional cone, in which case H7 is known as tri-Sasaki, has 3 Sasaki-Einstein structures. Just like this has 1 complex structure, this has 3 complex structures, so you get 3 Sasaki structures. And the dual field theory has N equals 3 supersymmetry. So how do we... So they're all dual to some 3-dimensional conformal field theories, or if you have examples. To find deformed solutions, Meldacini says all you need to do is find solutions that have a U1 cubed isometry, and if you want to preserve supersymmetry, then that U1 cubed action should commute the supersymmetry. So one can just go through the old literature and see what are the possibilities. So there's homogeneous examples, homogeneous study versions of H7, and some inhomogeneous examples. So starting off with the least supersymmetry, weak G2, there's a two-parameter family of cosets, ST3 mod U1, which have isometry ST3 cross U1. So they indeed have a U1 cube symmetry. And there's also the squash 7 sphere. In the Sasaki-Einstein case, there's a manifold called Q111 and another one called M32. And these are both S1 bundles. And here we have an S1 bundle over S2 cross S2 cross S2. And S1 has winding 1, 1, 1 over those 3, 2 spheres. So it's the exact analog of T11, just pushed up to 7 dimensions. M32 is an S1 bundle over CP2 cross S2. And the final example is that one of these spaces, coset spaces M11, actually, if you choose the metric correctly, has 2 Einstein metrics, and one of them is tri-Sasaki. So we have a list of examples to look at. And we also have some inner-homogeneous examples. So when I said that the 5-dimensional Sasaki-Einstein manifolds can be generalized to 7 dimensions, they precisely generalize these ones. So just like the YPQ generalized T11, the new 7-dimensional metrics generalize this class of metrics. So I think that's what I say there. Okay, so if we deform these solutions, what happens? So let me just run through the different cases. In the tri-Sasaki case, so as I said, there's just one example that we know of, N11, and it has an exactly marginal deformation that breaks N equals 3 supersymmetry down to N equals 1 supersymmetry. And that seems to be rather generic. I mean, that is generic, that if you had N equals 3 supersymmetry with these U1 cubed action, it would always just preserve N equals 1 supersymmetry. The next possibility is the Sasaki-Einstein, which was these examples I just mentioned. And these all have exactly marginal deformations, and they all preserve the full N equals 2 supersymmetry that the undeformed solutions had. And finally, the weak G2 case with the smallest amount of supersymmetry, NKL and the squash 7 sphere, they have exactly marginal deformations that maintain N equals 1 supersymmetry. Okay, so what can we say about the field theory? So in the Luna-Meldacena paper, they said for the solutions of the form ADS5 cross X5, of 2B, for example, with a U1 cross U1 isometry, they had a nice argument using string field theory by basically just thinking about the D3 brains sitting transverse to these Calabi-Yau three-fold cones, that the dual versions of the deformed geometries are simply obtained by just adding some simple phases into the Lagrangian. Basically, you get some non-commutative products in the dual field theory, but in this particular context, it turns out they're just adding particular phases into the Lagrangian. And in the cases they looked at, these phases just appear in as modifications to the superpotential. So let me give you an example. ADS5 cross T11. So this has, ignoring the baryonic symmetry, this has SU2 squared cross U1 global symmetry. And this U1 is the R symmetry of the dual field theory. And this is, I think, it's already appeared in one talk before, this is a SUN, I think Christian's talk, SUN squared quiver gauge theory. And we have these fields A and B that are in the 2,1 of SU2 squared, and the NN bar of SUN squared, and B is in the 1,2 of SU2 squared, and the NN bar of SUN squared. And there's a superpotential which preserves SU2 squared, which has the right R charge, which is given by that combination there. And what Klebanov and Witten showed is that the chiral primaries, which are dual to the Kaluza-Klein modes in the supergravity solution, are given by these traces of these operators, and these SU2 indices, which I've left open here, are actually symmetrized over they're symmetrized over all the SU2 indices. In other words, we're in the K on 2 representation, and delta is 3K on 2. And this symmetrization of the SU2 indices actually is guaranteed by the equations of motion coming from the superpotential. And Luna and Maldacena said, well, the gamma deformation, so that simple procedure on the supergravity, it precisely corresponds to this perturbation in the field theory. So you're just adding some phases in appropriate places into the superpotential. And what you notice is that for small gamma, this expression just becomes this. So here is a chiral primary. It's one of these operators here. And it has delta is 3. And in fact, it turns out to be the unique delta is 3 chiral primary, which breaks SU2 squared down to U1 cross U1. So if you didn't know about Luna and Maldacena, then you would have looked, you would have said, how can we deform the superpotential by a marginal operator? And you would have said, well, this is the operator that you can do if you want to preserve U1 cross U1. Then it's a non-trivial question whether it's an exactly marginal perturbation or not. And we now know that it is, because Luna and Maldacena, well, we know for other reasons that Luna and Maldacena have found the dual supergravity solution. So I want to come back to this point of view in a minute. Okay, so that's great for the 2B solutions. What about the M-theory solutions? So actually, we've also heard in the conference a couple of times that we know much less about these field theories living on the M2 brains, and that's basically because you can think of them as field theories living on D2 brains, but they get strongly coupled in the infrared, and we just have a very poor handle on what's going on. However, surprising to me, I just didn't know about this until we started thinking about this, is that there actually has been some progress on understanding the field theories of these spaces. So this group of Italians here, with some overlap with these people, have a conjecture or a description of, or a partial description of the dual field theories for ADS4 cross Q111, M32, and the tricyclic case N11. In particular, their description gives a chiral spectrum that agrees with the Kaluza-Klein modes, which is nice. And the very nice thing is that the description these manifolds have supersymmetric 5 cycles, which you can wrap 5 brains around, and you'll get baryons in the dual field theory. And the supersymmetric 5 cycles, the volumes of them, exactly agree with the baryons, the spectrum of baryons that you'd expect in the description of the field theory that they came up with. Okay, so if we have some handle on the field theory, can we see some evidence that there should have be some exactly marginal the marginal deformations corresponding to the solutions that we found? Well, we can't repeat the string field theory argument that Luna and Maldacena used for the D3 brains, but we can use this other point of view, and we can say, well, can we find the small deformation that's chiral with delta is 2 because we're in 3 dimensions rather than 4 dimensions, and it must preserve the U1 cubed global symmetry. So we see if there is such operators in the spectrum of operators that these people came up with. Okay, so ADS4 cross Q111. So the global symmetry, ignoring the baryonic branches, is SU2 cubed cross U1, and this is really the R symmetry of the field theory. And these people said that this is an SUN cubed quiver gauge theory. In fact, if you blow your eyes, it's very obvious, similar to the T11 case. So SUN squared has gone to SUN cubed. Instead of two basic fields, A and B, we now have a third one, and they're in the obvious representations of this SU2, 211, 121, 112, and the obvious representations of the gauge group, SUN. But one of the big differences from the four-dimensional case is that there's no superpotential. You can't write down a superpotential that preserves SU2 cubed. That's one of the mysteries of these field theories, because the chiral primaries that agree with the Klupka-Klein spectrum are these traces, trace ABC to some power K, and like in the T11 case, they must be symmetrized over all SU2 indices. That's to get agreement with the supergravity spectrum. But here, because we have no superpotential, all the other representations of SU2 cubed that you can construct out of these traces aren't eliminated by the superpotential as they was in the T11 case. So you just have to make a leap of faith and say, well, I mean, this is a gauge theory, and we're just going to flow in the infrared to this conformal fixed point, and you just have to assume, by some undetermined mechanism, that the other operators are just going to decouple in the infrared, and that this really is the spectrum of chiral primaries. So this is not satisfactory, but to my mind, it's quite impressive that they could come up with this description at all. And as I said, the nice thing is that this description does agree with the dimension of the baryons that you can calculate from the dual geometry. So it's not a trivial construction. Okay, so for small gamma, what is the superpotential deformation that we construct that in this language that we've constructed the supergravity solution for? Well, what I said is that it should have delta as 2. So, I mean, in these operators, we should take trace AB squared. And from what I said here, that is in a 3, 3, 3, spin 1, spin 1, spin 1 representation of SU2 cubed. And that has a unique element which preserves U1 cubed. So this is spin 1 of SU2. So you just take the neutral element of each piece. So this operator has a unique element with delta as 2 that preserves the U1 cubed isometry. So this is the small gamma, the marginal deformation, which actually, from a supergravity point of view, we say is exactly marginal. Okay, and that story basically goes through very similarly for M32, which I'm not going to tell you in any detail, and also for the N11 case. So it's rather nice that you can, I mean, the supergravity construction due to lunar Melvacino is a very simple construction, but it's nice that you can get a parallel description in terms of the field theory. Okay, and then just to wrap up. So I still believe that classifying supergravity solutions is still a profitable endeavor on many fronts. But just on the ADS side that I've been discussing, I still think there's a lot more to be done. And one of the obvious things is, given the ease in which Luna and Meldacena constructed these beta deformations for ADS 5 cross S5, I think it's very profitable to return to the question of whether there's a three complex family of deformations which are meant to be exactly marginal. And from the work of Aharoni and company, it will just seem this is an impossibly difficult program. But now one of them has been constructed by the simple duality transformation. I see no obstacle in principle why the other ones can't be constructed in a similarly straightforward way. So I think that's probably the most immediately interesting question. I mentioned that the field theories for these Q11 spaces and the M32 spaces, we have this description due to these Italian groups. Well, the new cohomogeneity 1 seven-dimensional Sasaki-Einstein manifolds that we have, they should have some similar generalization of those field theories. And I think that it should be possible to find out what those field theories are. The quivers will get a bit more complicated, but one should be able to find some similar description. And then with that, one could check consistency with the deformations that we found. It would be, I think the hardest thing in this area is that there's no description of the field theories for the solutions that just preserve one supercharge in three dimensions. So in H7, it has weak G2 holonomy. That may be a very hard problem. More generally, we did was classify. I mean, the starting point was classifying ADS5 solutions in 11 dimensions, but one could classify ADSN solutions for other n in both 2b or d equals 11. And in Christian Robbinsberger's talk, he mentioned finding a particular ADS5 solution in 2b. And on the one hand, where that problem has got to is solving these PDEs, which is very difficult. So it could be that just we're reaching the limit of finding these exact solutions. On the other hand, it could be that solution is just near at hand, and it could be just one particular example of a very large family of explicit solutions. So I'm fairly confident there's more to be. We weren't just incredibly lucky by just choosing one example where we could push through the calculations to the end. I think it's very likely that if one tries other examples, similar nice things will happen. On Friday, there was a paper by Svetich, Lu, Page, and Pope, and they basically generalized these YPQ spaces in five dimensions to have another parameter. So there's now not just YPQs, there's LPQR spaces. And all of the work that's been done on the YPQ spaces will now be done for these spaces within a very small amount of time. The toric description will be found, the dual field theory will be found, the A maximization will be done, the baryon. So feel free to compete with 10 other groups. This will happen very soon. But I was very surprised personally that the metrics could be generalized by another parameter. Partly because, well, there's so many reasons. That's clearly going to be an active area in the next few months. This is maybe as far as one could go, but you could ask the question, well, what about more general types of geometries due to more complicated field theory situations, for example, renormalization group flows? And you can just apply the classification tools to do this problem, but I think most likely you're going to end up with PDEs and not be able to solve the problems explicitly. But I think that's worth trying some systematic analysis there. And just let me just end with a very vague comment, which is that obviously the construction of explicit solutions will stop at some point. I mean, in a sense, in supergravity, there was a huge amount of work in the 80s finding lots of different types of solutions. Then that slowed down. Duality revolution came in the 90s. There was another big phase of exact solutions, intersecting brains and so on. And then people felt, well, that's the end of it. We'll find no more. But in the last year or two, black rings and these ADS solutions and so on, there's been another wave. So I think the demise of supergravity solutions is, perhaps a little bit, people have been saying it's a bit too, I don't think it's there yet. But at some point anyway, it will stop. There will be just all the solutions that we can close in closed form. And when that happens, of course, that won't be the end of the story. We'll just be wanting to have more sophisticated tools to analyze these geometries. So just like all the work in Clavial space-times is not actually looking for explicit solutions, it's using much more elaborate tools to study the geometries. And I think that's where all this program is actually going in the very longer term. So once you have some precise characterization of an ADS geometry, it has all this topological data, then what would you like is some analog of Calabi's theorem, which says, well, if you have some topological data, there does exist a Calabi-Yau metric, and then you can study manifolds of that topological data. So similarly, if you're looking for geometries of a certain ADS symmetry, then there might be some topological criteria given this classification, and then if you have that, you're guaranteed a solution. But that kind of analog of Calabi's theorem, clearly that's going to be very difficult, and it's something for the mathematicians to pick up rather than the physicists. And I'll stop there.
Um,
Yeah, so the way they construct it is by Euclideanizing rotating black holes, de Sitter rotating black holes. Yeah, and our metrics appear when the two angular momentum in five dimensions are equal. And so all they did is take the regular geometries and the two angular momentum are non-equal, and that difference gave the extra parameter. And so one of the reasons I was surprised, you'd expect supersymmetry basically to manifest itself as the two angular momentum being equal. So that was my intuition why that this wouldn't work. So some Japanese first recovered our metrics that way, and then the new development was doing that. But I'm slightly surprised because our two parameters labeled topological data, which is U1 windings of S2 cross S2, the two churn classes, and I don't know what their extra parameter corresponds to topologically in the geometry itself. Yeah, I'm not sure what the answer is. I mean, the field theory argument is rather strong.
But well, in some cases, there's a separate field theory argument.
Yeah, exactly.
But now you want to sort of apply it to these other people. Now you're turning
around. Yeah, right. That's true.
Your field theory should be exactly marginal.
That's true. That's right. That would be a caveat. So it could just fail. It could only be that the n goes to infinity limit strictly if this happens. The intuition is to do with black holes, not black rings. So if they had taken a black ring and done that, then that would be fine. But they took a black hole. So that's why I was surprised. But it's... Yeah. Well, it's after you wick rotate and it just miraculously appears at the end. I mean, you've got to take some scaling limit of the solution as well. So I agree. Sorry, which ones? The Well, so the ADS solutions in the ADS cross Sasaki-Einstein, then you have these exactly marginal deformations which are continuous, and in the Luna Maldacena paper, they at least worked out the semiological metric on that space on that moduli space. But these YPQ spaces in and of themselves, they are, they are discrete numbers. So they're just separate spaces. I guess, well, if you take the cone itself, I mean, there's ways of resolving that cone, preserving the Calabi-Yau structure. So, in that sense, it's a moduli. So you can start blowing up two spheres, just like the resolved conifold. So there'll be some paired Heliopolis term in the linear sigma model description. So there'll be moduli there. But then as ADS 5 plus YPQ spaces, then there's not metrically deformations, but there's deformations that involve the fluxes, which exactly give the Luna Melder phenotype solutions. Does that sort of answer the question? We can discuss.
In the first part of your talk, you talked about getting new solutions from old ones by applying a metric calculation. But isn't that in some sense just the same solution as before? If you've got
old
solutions...
I mean, if it would be for the duality transformations which are sitting in SL2Z. But if it's SL2R, that's just the symmetry of the supergravity but not the string of Aram theory. So at those special points, yeah, you would have just found some different description of the same model.
So,
so that at least it allows in. So in supergravity, they are really the same thing.
Not in 11 dimensions, no. In 8 dimensions, they are. But in 11 dimensions, they're different. I mean, it's like taking a Kaluza-Klein monopole, reducing down, doing a tree duality, going back to 11 dimensions. If you get to a 5 brain or something, it doesn't mean they're the same objects. No, well, for the M-theory case, we've done too much except to see that the exact marginal perturbation, but for the ones that Luna Meldacena did, then you see exactly what the superpotential is, and there's a phase, the C to the I beta, and that's a different field theory.
Well, there's a theorem that planar graphs, when you perform a theory in a non-commutative way, planar graphs are the same with and without non-commutative separation. Seems to me that this would apply to the field theory. So planar graphs and these two theories will just be identical.
Hmm.
So the partition function of two field theories would be just the same.
Hmm.
Which seems to match the fact that
you've got
all these
other symmetric Yeah, so in general I wouldn't expect it, except for the values when you're sitting in the SL2Z rather than SL2R. But I think Shrav's saying something more general. That, I mean, if I just write down that deformation and that superpotential with that e to the I beta, forget about everything else, you're just suggesting an argument that says, in fact, that's going to have exactly the same partition function with beta 0. And I don't know, that's an interesting question. I don't...
I could be wrong.